It is Tuesday, July 12, 2005. We're convening the House Special Committee on Budget, Subcommittee on Human Services and Public Safety. We have three items that we want to deal with. The first one involves John Britton as our LFO analyst, and since he's here, we'll deal with that one first, and then we'll move on to the other two bills. And so with that, we'll start a work session on Senate Bill 510. And Mr. Britton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, Senate Bill 510 continues an existing moratorium on the new licensure of assisted living and residential care facilities. It is currently set to end this moratorium on it should have ended June 30th, 2005. This would extend it to 2009. It also establishes an annual fee of $5,000 for moratorium applicants, so it would raise some revenue to the tune of about $500,000. And it establishes, in the B engrossed version, a residential care facility licensing moratorium fee sub-account, and allows the continuous appropriation of funds that are deposited into that account to the Department of Human Services. In the DHS budget, both the House version and the Senate version, these other funds would be used to fund Package 105, which was for adult protective services. Now, we're working on the B engrossed version of the bill. We've handed out a fiscal impact statement and a staff measure summary for the work that was done in the House Committee on Health and Human Services to get to the Senate Bill 510 B engrossed version. I would tell you that there is a proposed amendment to the B engrossed version, and I can go that through that if you'd like, Mr. Chair.
Yes, please.
Okay. I'll hand that out to you. Although this proposed amendment is to the A engrossed version of the bill, we can adapt it to the B engrossed version, which is the bill that we need for budget purposes. And on line 5 of the amendment, that first part in line 24 would be stricken, and we would put on page 2, line 2 of the B engrossed version. We would just add that in lieu of in line 24. And what this amendment is doing is saying that instead of, as is now in the B engrossed version, when a residential care facility makes an application, we're replacing that language with a person, because a person is the one who is making the application
to build
the residential care facility.
Okay.
So that's the effect of the 510A4. Now it will be a B engrossed amendment.
Okay, so essentially this bill has two functions. The first function is the one that was designed for originally, which was to require that there be fees paid annually for residential care facility, an option to build residential care facilities, which predated the moratorium.
That's correct.
And then the second part is to say that the revenues generated by those fees that are paid will go to, you know, through kind of a circuitous way, but they're going to go to fund adult protective services.
The bill doesn't specify adult protective services. It says that the money will go into that particular account. And the intention, though, in the DHS budget is to send the money on and use it for adult protective services.
Are there any questions on what's been presented?
Yeah, are these Doc Bates or Senator Bates amendments? Is he aware of all this?
I talked to him yesterday. Oh. He's aware of it, but they're actually ones that I generated.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. The goal, in my opinion, was to help assure that adult protective services had funding needed to help make sure that there could be investigators to go out and help with the seniors. And as you know, sometimes it's hard to find the pockets of money to do that. And this is one that was available that was an appropriate use. If there's no other questions about it, we accept the motion. Representative
Well,
Hansen.
Yeah, I'm just trying to sort sort out the way this works. We put a moratorium on residential care facilities. The people that were affected by that moratorium but haven't... We're taxing people for not for not going forward.
There was a period of time when adult living facilities were kind of financed to many extent by government financing and so forth to help promote them. The number of facilities was growing quite rapidly. There became a concern about the number, and so it was decided that there would be a moratorium. But rather than just say, if you haven't already filed for a building permit, you're cut off, then basically it was said that if you had plans of doing one, then you could be grandfathered and not affected by the moratorium. And that was like 2001, wasn't it? And so there are still nearly 100 of those grandfathered options to build that predated the moratorium where there's been nothing done. And so what this is doing is saying, if you want to continue to be actively considered as having the right to build with the pre-moratorium grandfathering, then you need to start paying a fee to do that. And either way, it needs to be done within the next several years.
And these facilities, if they chose to go forward, could go forward?
Right. Yes.
Okay.
Further question? Chair, have a motion to amend the be engrossed with the proposed amendments and to...
Mr. Chair?
Representative Hanna.
I would make a motion to amend the be engrossed version of Senate Bill 510 with the amendments as adjusted by LFO.
Yeah, the conceptual
amendment. The conceptual amendment.
Okay, Representative Hanna moves that the A4 amendments as conceptually changed will be amended to the be engrossed Senate Bill 510. Is there a discussion? Is there objection to the amendment? Hearing none, so ordered. And now we have 510 as amended in full committee.
All right. Mr. Chair, I'd move that Senate Bill 510 as amended be moved to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Hanna moves Senate Bill 510 as amended to the full House Budget Committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Is there objection?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wisnett.
Mr. Britton, who determines if the area is underserved? Is there a formula, a population per?
Mr. Chair and Representative Wisnett, I'm trying to remember if the assisted living or the residential care facilities are subject to the certificate of need process. I do not think they are. No. People are shaking their heads. No. So there is no determination as to whether a particular area is underserved with these. Or overserved, for that matter.
Thank you.
Further discussion? Is there an objection to the motion to move this bill as amended to full committee? Hearing none, Senate Bill 510 as amended is moved to the full House Committee on Budget with a due pass recommendation. Representative, well, you know what? I think I'll go ahead and bring this.
Okay.
And with that, we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 510. Thank you. Mr. Britton, appreciate it.
Thank you.
We now will open a work session on House Bill 3370 relating to implied consent. And we'd invite Representative Barker to come forward. And before we begin, we can get just kind of an overview from Mr. Borden.
Good morning, Chair Richardson and members of the committee. HB 2313, I've placed several handouts in front of you.
Okay, now we're dealing with the 3370.
Oh, pardon me.
if you want. Sure, Representative Clark would be happy to.
I could actually wait, Mr. Chair, if that would. I have time.
That's fine.
Okay.
We'll shift. Okay. 3370. I decided to move 3370 ahead to accommodate Representative Barker's schedule.
Do we have to vote on that?
Only if you want to call parliamentary point of order.
Chair Richardson, members of the committee have placed several handouts in front of you. You have a copy of the original measure, a preliminary staff measure summary for 3370, the fiscal impact, and then the staff measure summary from the substantive committee, the Judiciary Committee. There are no amendments to this bill that I'm aware of. The substantive committee passed out 3370 on April 29th by unanimous vote. The measure modifies the current violation under ORS 813095 from refusal to take a breath test to refusal to take a test for intoxicants. This includes not only refusal to take a breath test, but also refusal to submit to a blood or urine test. The measure does not change the level of offense or penalties. Violations are subject to a fine of between $500 and $1,000. The measure also redirects fines collected for such violations to the Oregon State Police account for driving under the influence of intoxicants laws. Of additional note, and the measure applies to citations issued on or after July 1st, 2006.
Okay. All right. With that, Representative Barker, could you fill in the space for us?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jeff Barker. I'm a state representative from District 28, Beaverton and Alola. First, let me thank you for having a hearing and a work session today on this bill. I do appreciate how much work the Budget Committee in general, and in particular, this subcommittee is doing. I'll try to keep my comments brief. House Bill 3370 extends the fine for refusing to comply with the law enforcement efforts to establish whether or not an individual is driving intoxicated to include refusing urine and blood tests. This is necessary because breathalyzer tests are only used for detection of alcohol and cannot be used to establish whether someone has been driving under the influence of other intoxicants. In the Judiciary Committee, we heard testimony about the use of urine tests being necessary for the admission of drug recognition expert testimony in court. The money collected from fines would go to support the Department of State Police for enforcement of driving while intoxicated laws. This is a very good bill. I appreciate your consideration today, and I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Questions for Representative Barker? Representative Hansen.
Thank you. Representative Barker, I'm have no problem in terms of expanding to cover other types of tests other than the breath test. What's the rationalization for the shift of funding into the state, solely for state police rather than spread out more, staying with local agencies that are...
I believe this came from the governor's task force on DUI and drunk driving. And they were concerned because of the lack of funds the state police have had. They get less and less. And they thought this would feed back, and primarily because the state police labs have to do the work. And so that would help cover that cost and keep the state, the Department of State Police, from, instead of making a hole in their budget, we would help support them this way.
Okay. So it's envisioned that it would be going for the lab work, primarily for the
board? Well, it says for enforcement of the DUI law, so it could do that. I'm to be honest with you, I don't remember specifically, but it seemed to me that was the reason.
You know, there's in a recent budget that we passed for state police, I think there was 171 new toxilizers that were being purchased. Do you know anything about whether or not those relate only to alcohol?
They would only relate to alcohol. That's the breath test, so.
Yes, and that's what I assumed, but I didn't know if technology had got to a point.
I don't think it has yet.
Should be. No. Representative, wasn't that Representative Boone?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Barker, did the committee discuss a higher fine?
I don't think we did. The $500 to $1,000 we felt was adequate, and one of the people had come in and said, "Gee, that's too much of a fine for poor people because it would," But so the answer to that is, don't drink and drive in Oregon. But we didn't. We tried to keep it within reason, and so we did leave it at that at this time.
Follow up, Representative Barker. Did you check other states how much they charge if you refuse?
I don't recall if we did or not. We didn't.
Just, Mr. Chair, I think I'm for the bill and we'll support the bill, but I'm worried that, someone that's really done this, he might want to refuse and pay the $1,000. It's going to be cheaper than what could be the results if he took the test. So I just want to be sure we're making it hard enough that we're going to get the guy or the lady. I'm just worried that some of the people out there might say, I won't take it, so I'm going to have to pay $1,000, not have to worry about answering to the courts about killing someone or whatever.
Well, if somebody's killed, you can usually get a search warrant to do a blood draw, and in those cases, but in being stopped, and we'll take a look at the numbers next, when we come back next time, and if we need to enhance that, I'll certainly try to do that.
Thank you.
Representative Boone.
Well, my question is just if there's I'm trying to read this with bad glasses and small print. If there is a time frame for these tests, the blood test and the alcohol test, or the urine test?
They would have to be pretty close in proximity because that would be argued in court.
Right.
If you waited too long, then they wouldn't be.
At their expense. So are they arrested? And then how does that work? I see some nodding back there. So it's pretty immediate then, within a time.
It would, yeah. Yes, it would. Same thing with the breathalyzer. When you do a breathalyzer, you time it. And then so it's from when you were stopped to when they're taken and actually given the test. And then it can be determined that there are argued. Sometimes they argue, well, gee, that was higher than I really was because I just drank when I drove and then it went up afterwards and so on. But so all that's taken into can be argued in court.
And then follow up. One additional related piece. If the person's injured and taken into the hospital, then it depends on the hospital and situation sometimes as to what happens next. And if it's a trauma entry, they might delay that piece of it while they treat the person. Is that factored in there at all, or does that?
I don't think we factored that in. Normally, a hospital will take a blood sample pretty early on.
Right.
And then that can be subpoenaed later.
Okay. That's what I was getting at. Thanks.
Okay. Any further questions? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee.
Yes, please. I'm not able to understand. On this one, I need to get some additional information, so we won't be moving the bill today. So we'll be rescheduling that one. So with that, I'm going to be closing the work session on 3370 and opening a work session on House Bill 2313. Mr. Martin.
Chair Richardson, members of the committee, HB 2313A is related to sentencing. You have the measure in front of you, the engrossed version, preliminary staff measure summary, fiscal impact for the engrossed version, as well as a copy of the substantive committee's staff measure summary. There are no amendments that LFO is aware of. The engrossed version passed out of the full Judiciary Committee on May 13th with a vote of 7 ayes and 1 nay with 1 absence.
Pearson flip off again.
Yes.
Mr. Chair.
Pearson, what's that?
It looks like the 6-3 summary report has 8-1, not 7-1.
That's what I just showed you.
Yes,
I'm looking at that right now.
My apology. The measure passed out on the 13th of May with 7 aye votes, 1 nay, and 1 absent. The measure modifies a crime of personal felony, unlawful use of a weapon, and felony in possession of a firearm by adding participation in a criminal street gang as a sentence enhancement factor. Convictions under this measure would receive 24 additional months above the presumptive sentence or require 24-month prison sentence where the presumptive sentence is probation. The measure would apply to offenses committed on or after the 1st of January 2006. And there is one note about the fiscal impact statement. The fiscal impact statement would increase general fund costs for the Department of Corrections institutional operations by $478,314 for the 2005-07 biennium and reduce community corrections general fund by $140,391. So the net fiscal impact shows as for the Department of Corrections as $337,923 in general fund. Legislative Fiscal Office notes that if this measure were to become law, and given that the Department of Corrections budget is already through the process, the department would need to appear before a legislative emergency board and request authorization to transfer the community correction savings of $140,391 into the institutional operations. And this would be done as part of DOC's normal rebalance during the interim. Additionally, LFO notes that DAS would incorporate into the prison forecast model any changes resulting from this measure if it were to become law.
This is the Speaker's bill, and I did meet with Chair Scott this morning on the fiscal to make sure that in the grand scheme of things there was the money available to do this, and he assured me that it was calculated into it and that it was there. And having considered all of these things, that's why it was sent to our committee to review. It has an 8-0 passage by the policy committee, and so we're here, you know, to work the bill. Are there any questions about the bill, Representative Wynton Hanson?
Well, yeah. Is there any type of a formula that's used in terms of what the extra construction of the extra 50 jail beds will cost? Right now we've got we're back to the gills and we're having to add space for every new person that comes in during this biennium and towards the end of the biennium. If this adds 50 additional convicts for two additional years, we've got significant expense generated for prison construction.
Chair Richardson, Representative Hanson, there are several factors that I would point out, and they are detailed in the fiscal impact in general, and that is on the second page, the 50 new convictions would not translate precisely into 50 new prison beds due to such things as phase-in of the crime and other timing issues. I think by the estimates that we've received, it looks like 36 additional beds. And to my knowledge...
Actually, in the report, it says... For the 07-09 biennium, 77 new prison beds would be needed.
Yes, I was for 05-07, 36 prison beds, and for 07-09, then it rises to 77 prison beds.
Right. Do we have a cost for what those will do?
And those costs are reflected on the front of the fiscal impact. Chair Richardson, Representative Hansen, the 0507 costs are the $478,314.
Yeah. We're having parallel conversations, I'm sorry. Those are the operational costs. I'm talking about the new prison construction costs. When we're talking about the construction of a facility at Madras, what proportion of the Madras facility costs are going to be used up by this one particular bill?
That kind of crosses into other areas if you want to have Doug Wilson also.
Yes, Chair Richardson, I think Doug will.
Mr. Chair, for the Department of Corrections, their fiscal impacts are based on a daily per day costs. Given the construction schedule, whether it's the Senate or House version, it would probably mean opening up a unit or accelerating the opening of units at Madras 4709, for example. And since that is roughly a 2,100 bed unit, you know, it will be until probably the 09-011 budget until you start backing up on that capacity.
Question, Doug, do you have a ballpark figure in terms of like construction cost per bed?
I don't have it off the top of my head. I could get it to you. I don't recall that number exactly.
But what I'm hearing you say is that the construction is going to go on either way. This will merely take some of those beds, and the beds are not going to be immediately filled by other prisoners anyway.
That is right. Since Madras is coming on in stages, unit by unit, a bill like this or the combination of number bills would mean that they would come on maybe a little bit quicker. And the fiscal takes that into account because it's based on an average daily rate.
What the bill does is, you know, we're focusing on the meth that they make, but this bill is saying don't forget the fact that we have in some parts of the state huge gang problems, and that this is to give greater teeth in enforcement to stop gang-related crimes, so that those that are participating understand that they're going to pay to play. They want to do crimes in gangs. There's going to be an increased risk of longer imprisonment, or at least automatic imprisonment. So, you know, so it does affect the sentencing guidelines for those kinds of crimes in that kind of activity.
Mr. Chair.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Borden, in your reading of the bill, does this measure take away the judge's ability to, does it create automatic sentencing for these crimes? The judge no longer has any leeway?
Chair Richardson, Representative Hannah, that is my understanding of the bill, especially in regard to the probation factor.
Okay, thank you. Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hannah,
the 50 new convictions, is that per biennium or annually?
Chair Richardson, Representative Hannah, that would be 50 new convictions per biennia.
So, follow up, Mr. Chair. Roughly 25 new convictions for an issue that's going to cost a couple million bucks to incarcerate these folks. And when we can't put enough state troopers on the road, I guess I have a problem looking at a measure that doesn't allow those professionals, the judges, to make some decisions on their own on some of these issues. And once again, we're taking away their ability to do their job. And the fiscal position that we've been in makes this very difficult.
Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could we have a quick rundown? This modifies the unlawful use of a weapon and felon in possession of a firearm. What types of sentences are they already receiving prior to this?
Chair Richardson, if I may suggest, Heidi Moab, the counsel for the Judiciary Committee, is here, and she may be able to better answer that question.
Very fine. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, members of the committee. Heidi Moad, I was the Judiciary Committee counsel who worked on this bill. I also, just for the record, before coming to work for the legislature, was assigned to the gang unit in Multnomah County District Attorney's Office prosecuting non-ballot Measure 11 gun crimes. So the crimes I prosecuted the most were unlawful use of a weapon and felon in possession of a firearm cases. Those are level 6 offenses on the sentencing guideline grid block. And so if you have little to no criminal history, you would be in a presumptive probation grid blocks, 36 months presumptive probation. Once you get to a E on the grid block, which is 3 or more non-person felonies, you start getting into presumptive prison. A 6E is 10 to 12 months. A 6A, which is the most serious, you could be at 3 or more person felonies, is, I believe, 25 to 30 months presumptive prison with a 24-month post-prison supervision period. So it kind of varies. There is another small layer at play here that if the gun itself is used or threatened to be used in the commission of a felony, there is the firearm mandatory minimum of 60 months. My suspicion is that 60-month minimum and that 24-month minimum probably, I don't know how those would play in together, but then you wouldn't be looking at fiscal for the next 2 biennia in any event. So,
okay. How, I would think most, thank you. Sorry. I would think most of the people involved in this type of activity, by the time they get to court, there's also a felony involved. How is it very common to have somebody that's only involved solely on the firearm violations?
Representative Hansen, members of the committee, I would say that the reason that felon in possession of a firearm and unlawful use of a weapon are specifically listed here, the thought was that to avoid an even higher fiscal impact, that we would, as the committee wanted, to limit the crimes, the applicability of crimes to start out, just to see what happens with a sentencing enhancement scheme of this type in the state. So property crimes and drug crimes were specifically accepted, essentially, by listing. We wanted to do violent person felonies, which are going to fall under the rubric of ballot measure 11 in a lot of cases in any event. And then we wanted to have the other sort of weapons crimes included, felon in possession of a firearm and unlawful use of a weapon. Obviously, for felon in possession of a firearm, the person is walking in the door with at least one felony conviction as an adult. But the unlawful use of a weapon, those are typically your drive-bys where nobody is hit or hurt, fortunately. But then the person's looking at presumptive probation for what prosecutors would argue is a pretty dangerous act.
Thank you.
Rosie, wasn't it?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. After our last committee meeting, we talked about our supposed to be looking at the financial, and hopefully the committee's done their job. I'd like to follow up on Representative Hannah's questioning to Mr. Borton. I don't understand how you came up with these financial numbers if, like Representative Hannah said, we're talking about 50 people in 2007-2009. That's $500,000 per prisoner. And how we jump from...
$500,000 per prisoner? What's that based on?
The 50 additional.
Okay, you said per prisoner.
Per additional bail that we're going to have to add.
Representative Richardson, I'm not sure if I fully understand your question. The cost figures for the 50 new people entering the system were calculated by the Department of Corrections using their phase-in schedules on the daily rate of the $68 a day cost factor over the periods beginning April 2006. Is that
what is your additional question?
Well, we're saying we've got 50 additional prisoners. This is going to result in need for 50 more beds.
That's $68 a day.
And that equals $500,000 per bed?
No, total. You lost this one. With the
you got $2.5 million total cost.
For 07-09, and the number was 77, I believe, for 07-09, so...
We're still...
Do you want to break this figure down for us? It's 3,000, 3 million?
Sure. That
is that based on a daily bed rate times the number of expected incarceration?
That's right, and... I believe what Chair Richardson, Representative Wisnett, what really gets at the essence of this, from my understanding is that we're not just dealing with the 70, we're dealing with 77 beds, and Mr. Wilson may be able to clarify this a little bit better, but there is a constant rotation of inmates through the system. So we're not just dealing with, in one point in time, we're dealing with 77 beds, but there may be more inmates.
Mr. Chair, we've got 1,200 prisoners, and the total cost of the whole system is not but
12,000.
12,000 prisoners. And 12,000 prisoners, and what our budget for corrections is.
Mr. Chair.
This seems like a high number.
The annual cost is roughly $25,000 for the operational side of running the prison. There are other components of the corrections budget, so you need to be careful to factor those out, like community corrections. But the average annual cost at, you know, roughly the $68 figure is just under $25,000 per year, or $50,000 per biennium. If that gives you some, I don't have the fiscal in front of me, or I'm not a detailed. I don't know the details of this bill.
But 68 times 50 would be 200 million.
No, it's 24. Okay. 250
times 77. 5 times.
It is too many people in prison.
Times 2.
You can stay at a Holiday Inn for that.
Yeah. And see that?
That's what...
It does.
Is it right?
That's what that second biennium would be.
Yeah. One more financial question. When we're extrapolating the decreases for community corrections, are those actually decreases, or do those community correction dollars just get slid back? Eventually, the prisoners are going to be coming back and going to be subject to parole and probation and whatnot. So obvious. You know, I'm not saying this isn't factual, but don't the 585,000 community corrections savings in 07-09, are those going to be just push 2 years farther back after their release date?
Chair Richardson, Representative Hansen, that would be correct. Under the construct of a fiscal impact, we just look at the two biennial scope, and so those community correction costs would be pushed out into the future after
now,
the 24th.
Have any of the 140,000 in the 05-07, have those been accounted for in the 07-09 numbers?
Chair Richardson, Representative Hansen, yes, according to my understanding, in the Criminal Justice Commission analysis, they did incorporate those net probation costs that would have occurred into the future from that the original 140,000 decrease.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair. Representative Hannah.
May I ask a question of Ms. Moab?
Certainly.
Yeah. Thank you. In the earlier versions of this bill, there were the clothing, issues with what kind of clothing you were wearing or who you were hanging out with and so on. What's the criteria now for gang-related? I mean, what would you use as that criteria?
Chair Richardson and Representative Hannah, this bill has gone through a couple of versions, and perhaps a little history as to why we changed it might be helpful. One of the ideas, when we started out, we were kind of looking at all of the state's gang-related statutes. I think there are more than half of the states in the union, for sure, have some sort of gang-related statutes. California, and their Street Terrorism Enforcement and Prevention Act sort of started the ball rolling, and we originally did not base Oregon's version on the California STEP Act. However, as we got into that difficulty of the gang member and classifying an individual as a gang member and some of the inherent risks that were associated with that as far as allegations of racism and things of that nature, it became apparent to the committee that the thing to focus on was the behavior and the advancement of a criminal street gang as opposed to the individual's status as a gang member or not a gang member. And so that's why we removed all of those pieces about a gang member and instead focused on what a gang is, which is a group of at least three persons that has as its primary activity commission of criminal acts or acts, a common name, style of dress, identifying signs, colors, and symbols, and at least two members who have engaged in that pattern of street gang activity. And then that, of course, is also defined within the statute. And what we wanted to focus on was, did a person act with the intent to enhance that gang in some way, either financially or through a reputation or, you know, to protect turf or advance turf, things of that nature. So the focus became the behavior of enhancing the gang instead of the focus being on whether or not the person was a gang member, which becomes, as you can imagine, problematic from a constitutional perspective.
Further question? Mr. Warren.
Chair Richardson, there's one note that I would point out about the figures for 07, and that is on July 1 of 07, we do not begin the biennial with 77 additional inmates. It's a build-up. We begin with the 36 inmates, and then gradually over the course of the biennial build up to June 2009 of 77 inmates. So that, again, is a factor in why the costing is not straight mathematical.
Okay. All right. Further questions? Then the chair would accept a motion to move 2313A.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move the committee move House Bill 2313A to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Wisnant moves House Bill 2313A to the full committee with due pass recommendation. Discussion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be opposing this. I spent the same afternoon, I think a lot of the members did, on the tour of gang, the Multnomah County gang tour bus that we did, I think it was a year ago last spring. And I come to a complete, to a much different decision. If you look at all of the work that's being done in East Multnomah County and in North and Northeast Portland, which seems to be where the center of a lot of the activity is, we're getting some really good work done there. If we're going to be spending this kind of money, and $3 million is a lot of bucks, and we can debate whether it's $3 million plus the construction costs of 77 additional jail beds, or whether it's only the $2,500,000. It's still a very significant amount. We could virtually double the amount of money that we're putting into the Multnomah County Gang Task Force with just the dollars we're spending on this one very, very limited, very niche sentencing proposal. And I think there's a lot of needs that are much greater. Nobody is minimalizing the impact of the gangs in their neighborhoods. But rather than extending some sentences on people that we've probably already caught and are already facing convictions and already facing prison time. To get the bang for the buck that we're going to be getting for this investment is just minimal in comparison to what we could be spending by hiring street officers, additional probation officers, or developing programs to actually keep kids out of gangs in the first place. So I think this is just totally the wrong way to go. And will be a hard no vote.
Further discussion?
Mr. Chair, I also will be in opposition to this. I feel like we're spending money in a very isolated case for a very small group of folks when we could use that same kind of money to put troopers on the road that would cover all of Oregon, and that we're also, again, taking away the opportunity for our professionals, the judges, to make good decisions in their sentencing. And for those reasons, I'll also be a no vote.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To my good colleagues and friends, now we're talking about estimates of new bed requirements, and so I'm sure the committee that worked on this looked at what the impact here, and we're all hoping and praying that with this bill there won't be any more prisoners, that it'll be a deterrent to gangs and gang-related friends that will not have to use those 50 new beds.
Further discussion? Seeing none, clerk, call roll.
Representative Boone?
Aye.
Representative Hanna?
No.
Representative Hansen?
No.
Representative Wisnett?
Aye.
Chair Richardson?
Aye. House Bill 2313A, having received the required majority, is passed to full budget committee with a due pass recommendation. And Representative Wisnett, would you carry the vote? Are there further items for our committee today?
We're not going to vote on 3370?
Correct.
Okay.
We will stand adjourned then without further objection.